one, that the intuition to stay lean until you find PMF was right, because we did question that a lot, and we got, and it was very hard to maintain that conviction. It was some like really difficult conversations with stakeholders on like why we weren't, you know, scaling out or growing faster. I would tell myself like, no, that was right, and I probably could have saved myself some sleep if someone had told me that more people had told me that was right.
Welcome to the Product Market Fit Show, brought to you by Mistral, a seed stage firm based in Canada. I'm Pablo. I'm a founder turned VC. My goal is to help early stage founders like you find product market fit. Well, Scott, welcome to the show. It's awesome to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Pablo. Great to be here.
So, you know, now you run a company that's called Spellbook. Originally, that same company was called Rally Legal. And I remember, you know, maybe a few years ago, you spoke with me about that opportunity. And I was, you know, not smart enough to see the future, but maybe more so like to understand your own perspective into everything you need to do to find product market fit, which at the end of the day is like the key characteristic, I think, in the early stages. How fast can you move? How many experiments can you make? Because if you just keep doing that, at some point, you'll get it. And that's exactly what happened here. Spellbook now is like the ChatGPT for lawyers. So it couldn't be, I think, a cleaner positioning, but it took a long time to get there. So maybe to start, like we can start in the early days just to set context, like what was Rally Legal, and maybe more so, how did you kind of come up with that idea?
Yeah, we started Rally. There's myself and two co-founders, Matt and Daniel. Daniel was a lawyer. Matt was a mechanical engineer who had started a toy company. I come from an engineering and kind of product background, and I had started my first small, naive startup straight out of a university. Even before this, we launched this musical instrument, and I got my first little angel check of $20,000. And before I knew it, half that angel check was gone on legal fees. And I was like, what just happened? It was crushing for me. I thought that was a lot of money at the time for a company to have. And I was really frustrated with that. So I went on to become a director of engineering at another company for a while. But this problem really stuck in my head of like, wow, it's really hard to start a company when it costs so much just to get basic legal work done. This must be a problem for a lot of people. That became kind of my mission. And I was plugged into like the smart contract and Ethereum space for a while. I was like, oh, you know, for a while I thought, you know, smart contracts are going to take over and everything's going to become a computer-based contract and it's all going to be cheap. You know, I went to Ethereum hackathons and things like that, but we knew we needed to build something that people would actually use and that lawyers would use. And lawyers didn't seem too receptive to using Ethereum and smart contracts at the time. Knew there was this pain. So this set me personally on a mission, figure out how do we make legal services more accessible so we can have more entrepreneurs, so we can have faster sales cycles, you know, better employment contracts. You know, everything in the world runs on contracts. It's friction that is in every single transaction. And as an entrepreneur, I'd always been looking for like, what's an impactful mission that I could kind of dedicate my life to? And when I thought about the experience I had, and when I thought about the scale of this around the globe, like, if you go to the Stripe website, you see that globe with all the financial transactions happening around the world, you know, and their whole thing is like increasing the GDP of the internet. And I'm like, well, if we could decrease the friction of legal transactions by 90%, what does that do to the GDP of the earth? How many more people can start companies?
And so that's kind of the high level, right, to decrease friction, which I really like. What was the first pain point and value prop that you went after, and how did you land on that specifically?
Yeah, so I'll preface this with us, well, plus really our director of growth as well. We launched over 100 landing pages. So we've had a lot of different value props. Yeah. Okay. So I could tell you about a lot of experiments that we ran.
We'll definitely go through that.
Yeah. You know, the very first thing we launched, and it happened almost in like a couple of weeks, was really a template library for founders. We actually, the very first thing we did is like, you know, screw lawyers. We're just going to like bring templates to founders and, you know, whatever they need, we'll have. Launch that very quick. It wasn't very successful.
So like an employment contract, a safe doc, like whatever, a bunch of NDAs.
Etc. Yeah, exactly. And we had a bunch of people immediately sign up and pay us like $5 a month. And we were like, oh, geez, you can't, you know, this still isn't, it's going to take a long, long while to become ramen profitable on this. And, it was a hard sale because what we realized is even if you could automate the creation of these documents for people, they still have no idea what they say. They still need someone to trust. They still need someone to explain it to them. So we really quickly pivoted away from that. And at the same time, a law firm, a guy named Todd Bizet in Waterloo at Miller Thompson came to us, and he was like, oh, like our law firm is actually looking for templating technology in a way to streamline startup paperwork for our own clients. We saw what you have, and it looks actually really compelling. We actually worked with him and his team for a number of weeks to actually hone the product for law firms and to interface with clients so they could then use our product to like capture a bunch of information from clients. They could send like a questionnaire to clients and then suck that into templates, build a whole bunch of docs, and then do their bespoke editing. And so then that became, I would say, the core of the real Rally product was this Rally for law firms. And
did you, like, when you had this, you know, lawyer come to you and tell you about this problem set, did you just start designing with them, or did you also go and run like discovery and all these kind of classic, you know, PMF motions?
We definitely kind of went into kind of hyper focus on their problem. We actually worked out of the office for a little while. So like we were alongside lawyers who were doing real legal work. And so we kind of hyper-focused probably too much on one customer, to be honest, probably overfit our product a lot.
So that was your first product as well, like 2019-ish, you've got this product for law firms to help them kind of streamline their process of making simple documents. Is that maybe in broad strokes what it was?
Yeah, exactly. And then, yeah, we ended up raising like a pre-seed round from some East Coast investors early on after we had some initial revenue. We got a handful of other customers, law firms on board who were great early supporters. And yeah, and then we kind of, this is still 2019. And then we did a lot of iteration there to kind of get to, you know, something where we felt there was really deep PMF. And this is where the long, like those first customers were super exciting, but then it was at the valley of despair. Like I'm sure you've seen like the graph from like YC of kind of the typical startup trajectory, you know, really exciting getting these first customers, then getting to true PMF was, you know, this valley of years, really.
What happened? I mean, walk me through that, because I find this is so important to understand and hard to understand from the outside is, if you find one customer, five customers that really love it, you just assume there's got to be 1,000, right? And like, how can it be harder? It's got to get easier, not harder. What's your thinking on that? Why does that happen?
I think the biggest thing for us is, I don't think the initial customers, they love the idea of it. They love to buy it. They love the concept of it. But actually getting real usage, real engagement, real habit change, that was the hard thing. And even with these 10 customers, getting them to truly, you know, set up templates in our system, like time to value, we realized was really important. It took us a long time to figure that out, but like they had to do a lot of setup and configuration to get this to work. And then once they got it set up to work, so they had to basically set up these fancy legal templates in our system. And then often the legal teams would be like, oh, this is great. You know, all the other lawyers are going to love this. My work's a little bit too bespoke, but you know, all the other lawyers are going to love it. And we would hear that over and over and over again, where they so want to improve their process. They so want to embrace technology. But when the rubber meets the road and they have a live deal, they're like, oh, this is too bespoke for this templating engine, and they wouldn't use it. You know, it just from a usage perspective, it wasn't hitting the way we wanted. And I think especially if you're working with the large customers, large law firms, you know, the danger there is like the implementation cycle can be like a year, it can be like 2 years to technically get something rolled out, you know, past all the committees and to start getting feedback and do all the changes. And like, when all that time goes by, you don't know if you have product market fit or not. And that's really, really difficult. So I think we ended up switching to focusing on small, nimble firms who just adopt things really quickly. And then our iteration cycle, you know, sped up a lot. And we could easily see like, okay, we still don't really have deep PMF. The other way we measured PMF was CAC payback period. So we were just kind of a little bit religious about like, what's our CAC payback period? You doing this motion. And if the CAC payback period wasn't clearly well under 12 months, we're like, okay, we don't have PMF.
You're going after smaller clients. And you mentioned running many different experiments. You mentioned like hundreds of landing pages. Can you dive in on that? Like, what were some of the things you were testing? And then you mentioned CAC payback period. What were some of the outputs that you looked at to see if those tests worked?
Us, plus our director of growth, was also a huge part of this as well. So his name's Kurt Dunphy. Yeah, we roll over 100 landing pages with different value props, different. Often there's a new feature, a little feature we built, you know, to angle the product in a certain way. And yeah, we monitored these experiments at a variety of levels. And our goal was to run an experiment every 2 weeks. And so we would look at a lot of different things. We wouldn't just launch landing pages. We would also launch ads with those landing pages.
What's an example of that? maybe of, just take us through one of those experiments that you remember.
Yeah. So one of the experiments, which actually resonated a lot from a sales standpoint, was what we called our menu of services pitch. So we actually turned our templating system into a menu of services, or like a Shopify for law firms, that they could put on their website. So now not only did they have templates, they could actually advertise like, oh, you need a will or you need an employment agreement. Come into my website, click on need an employment agreement, put in all the info. That gets submitted to the lawyer, and the lawyer goes into the lawyer's template. The lawyer does their massage on it, and it goes, you know, the product goes back to the customer. So that was one of our actually hit experiments on the sales side, was kind of allowing a lawyer to almost set up like a little Shopify shop.
Why do you think that resonated?
Resonated because lawyers want to make money. They want clients and they want customers. You know, that's one of their biggest pains, is where's my next dollar coming from? Where's my next customer coming from? And the idea of having a digital storefront was really compelling. How we knew this worked? Well, first we ran ads and people were clicking those ads, and we would look at the cost, you know, the cost per click and the cost per conversion into a demo meeting. So what's the cost to get a lawyer into a demo meeting? It was way lower than anything else we had run before. And we knew that within 2 weeks of running these ads. So we had so much data. Okay, we threw up an ad, threw up a landing page. What is the cost to get someone to into a demo? Or we're like, wow, this is like 90% lower than anything we've run before. They love this. And then we took that, and then we, you know, were able to go and say, okay, let's take this experiment to the next step. Let's actually roll this feature out to all these customers, implement it, and see how it goes. This is where the problems started with that value prop. Again, the time to value issue, getting connected into their website. Lawyers could get this thing up and running, but they had no idea how to drive traffic to it. You know, they're kind of chasing this mirage of, and I'm sure Shopify has this issue too. They probably have tons of people setting up stores and no traffic going to those stores. So that was actually a killer problem for that direction for us.
So it's kind of, again, this notion that the reality doesn't meet the idea, right? Like people expect, you know, oh my God, it's going to drive all this traffic, but then the work it takes and all the nuances around it, don't let them realize that value.
Exactly. And that experiment passed the CAC payback test. I think our CAC payback was probably like 6 months on that whole motion.
Oh, wow.
Or less. But it didn't pass the retention and kind of the usage test. We look at usage retention cohorts a lot.
How much time? That one's tougher, right? Because don't you need like months of data to kind of see if it flatlines, or do you get to see it faster somehow?
Well, in this case, actually, yeah, I'm probably over explaining it, because in this case, I think you'd see what we call the wiggles of death, which is the customer signs up the product. You see those first, like, oh, they logged in. Oh, they did something. And you see a couple wiggles and then nothing.
It's like, okay.
At our company, we say, like, actually, most things you launch, that's the pattern you see. The wiggles of death is like, oh, the user's like, oh, there's a new feature, I'll play with it. And you see like a couple little spikes of people using it and then nothing. Mm-hmm. And in my mind, that is the default for most companies when they launch anything. You know, I was talking to another company the other day. They built this amazing like customer portal, and they were amazed that after like months of hyping up this portal, selling it to customers, they looked at the logs and no customer had ever logged into this portal almost any time. And it had all been their own internal users using it. And they thought people were using it. I was like, this is normal. This is actually what I see. This is the dirty secret of like SaaS, is like actually getting anyone to use anything, especially in 2024 when you're so distracted. There's so many other more exciting things to look at. Getting anyone to even log into a web app is like excruciatingly.
Reminds me of my usage of Threads. That's what.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I logged in once or twice. Yeah, the wiggles of death. That was my exact usage pattern. I logged in. I went there twice.
So that was one experiment. What were some of the others?
It's quite a lot. I think like client questionnaires was something we focused on a lot. So we had this idea of taking info from a client and feeding it into a template. But actually the questionnaire in its own right was useful as a product, because when you're onboarding a new legal client, you need to figure out, do they conflict with any of your other clients? There's a whole bunch of like KYC information you need. So we also had this client questionnaire angle of like, launch your client questionnaires. That was one that, you know, did pretty well. It was just like, it didn't have that amazing kind of physiological reaction from the customer on it. You know, some of the others, more advanced types of templating. We even went in terms of like, client portal is also something we launched. Like, hey, lawyers, now not only do you have all these templates and all this stuff, you also have a portal that your clients can log into.
And how do you, maybe one question that comes to me is like, everybody talks about, you know, you should just run a lot of experiments. Like, that's how you're going to have higher odds of finding something that has true product market fit. But the other current is that even like there's outside pressure, but even most founders I speak with, like they just want something that works. They just want something that scales. And so you kind of have this like yeah, you'd want to just run experiments endlessly until something just takes off, but also you just want to find something that works and scale it. Like, how did you manage staying disciplined, and what just was that process like while you're running all these experiments?
It was excruciatingly hard. You know, we had very high conviction that, like, product market fit should feel, having an almost physiological response from your customers, where when they see the product, their pupils are dilating, you know, there's like a neurochemical reaction happening. And I remember reading a quote, I can't remember exactly where it was from. I can't remember, you might know, but it was a quote that basically said, if you have product market fit, it should feel like basically the product is being pulled out of your hands faster than you can provide it. Your servers are on fire. Your salespeople are burnt out. That's what it should feel like. I can't remember where I had read that, but it really stuck in our heads. True product market fit. And this obviously doesn't always happen. Some people, especially in enterprise sales, sometimes it's just a grind the whole time. But we decided, like, we're not scaling the company. We're not upping our burn. And we're just staying incredibly lean and agile until we have a product that people are pulling out of our hands faster than we can provide it. And we're, like, you know, having enormous growing pains and everything's on fire. I would say that to our board. Our board's awesome. They've been very supportive, but they are very skeptical about this. You know, everyone so wants to believe that the thing that they're doing is the right thing. Everyone so wants to move on to the next stage and to start scaling, you know, moving on to the next thing, hiring people after you raise money. There's just a lot of pressure to put that capital to work as quickly as possible and scale the thing. And everyone wants to believe that you already know what the thing is.
Well, what are some of the arguments? Because this is where it gets really interesting. I think the rubber meets the road here. Like, on the one hand, you're coming here and you're saying, look, like, the cap payback period is not like this. If usage and retention, why would I scale? And it seems obvious, right? But I'm sure there's another argument on the other side. That's, what is that argument that tells you, no, you're overthinking it. Like, you just got to scale this thing and things will take care of themselves.
I mean, I do think there was a period of time where capital was in such excess and there was just kind of this social thing happening where everyone was kind of just watching each other and doing what everyone else was doing. This social mimicry, which I think is, you know, key to business and investing, is like, not mimicking what everyone else is doing, but it's actually in practice very, very hard. And, you know, blitz scaling was very popular at the time. And everyone's like, well, if you don't scale fast enough, a competitor is going to come in. Or, you know, if you don't start scaling up, you're not going to learn fast enough. You know, if you don't scale up, how is your team going to do anything if you don't hire 10 more people? I think there was, you know, largely a lack of belief at how much a small number of people could do for a little while. And I think a small number of people can do a lot, sometimes more than a larger number of people. If you're doing a new experiment every 2 weeks, it's very hard to get a 50-person team aligned on that. People get burned out pretty quick, but small team can do that.
I think that's one of the most mistaken beliefs, by the way, is that it's like there's all these things you should do. There's two worlds in my mind. There's pre-product market fit and there's post-product market fit, right? And one of the most classic things I see is, like, for whatever reason, implementing things that make sense post product market fit, but too early, right? And that goes for, like, you should hire a VP of this or a VP of that, right? Like, you need to scale, you need more developers. You actually don't need more production. Like, you don't need more output until you figured out, in your words, like, what the thing is. And staying lean means there's no overhead. It means you shift quickly. It means, like, this is my experience, this is one of the things that I think is just not, it's hard to appreciate until you've gone through it, which is, if you've got a lot of people, the amount of time you need to take to communicate every single time that you decide you're abandoning this and going that way is massive. And then all of a sudden, you've got people who worked on this thing. They don't want to let that thing go. They don't necessarily agree with the new direction. You're trying to just go here and then here and then here. It's like, you got five people. I don't know how many people you were actually, but I assume it was like 5-10 people or something. Not
5 to 8 people, like, around there. Yeah, yeah.
Everybody's aligned, right? And so that's a huge difference maker.
Exactly. And I have to give our engineering team so much credit for that as well. And our founding engineer, Matt Drover, you know, rolling with that. Because even with the small team of stuff, you know, it's not, you also have to hire people who are able and willing to do that. Building things over and over and seeing it not stick, it's like not normal. Like, people in big companies just don't, I don't know, you're kind of sheltered from the harsh reality, I think, a lot of the time, that, like, most things actually just don't work and suck and fail. And I think when you're up against raw reality with a small team, you see that and feel that. But, like, I think you can live a whole life as, like, a software engineer and not realize just how many things just completely fail and suck.
Did you think everything was going to maybe fail, like through that period? Did you and or your team think that at times?
Yeah, we did. And I don't think that's a good way to communicate it in a large company, but in a small company, we're like, we just got to assume everything's going to fail and we have to get to the next experiment. You know, invalidate this one and move on to the next thing was our approach. And that's
what about like, I mean, broader, like, did you ever think, you know what, maybe Rally just isn't going to work out? We're just not going to find product market fit. Was that something that, or not?
That honestly never really crossed my mind because I had so much faith in the problem and just like, there must be a way to make legal services 10x more efficient and, or 100x more efficient. And I know that everyone hates getting, you know, that really expensive legal bill. Everyone has how universal that experience is. So like, I think our faith in the problem and our mission was big enough to enable us to do that. Where if it wasn't, you know, if we weren't that motivated by the mission or we started to question, you know, does this problem exist at all? We would have abandoned it for sure. And so I think that was a really important part, like finding a problem that felt actually had to be a spiky, tough problem that hadn't been solved before that we felt motivated that should be solved, you know, helped our team, you know, stick to it and be like, you know, it's almost good that it's good that this is a hard problem because otherwise it would have been solved already. So we're just going to keep at it.
And so when does this, you know, like ChatGPT comes out, like walk me through how AI starts to play a role and then the transformation into Spellbook.
Yeah, we started experimenting with like GPT-2 very early, just totally on the side. It's not an OKR, it's not a project, it's not a strategy, it's just playing around and hacking. And that's like one pattern I had noticed in our successes is that they almost all arose from this sort of like evening and weekend hacking. They never arise from like the board meeting plan or like the quarterly plan. They always arise from like, oh, I'm going to try this thing after hours and see what happens. We started playing with GPT-2 early on. It wasn't really good enough to do anything with. Kind of sucked. But then when GPT-3 and GitHub Copilot came out, that's when we really saw promise. And this is when the aha moment really happened. And we knew immediately. As soon as I tried GitHub Copilot as a programmer, what I saw is that I could have bespoke code on my screen and the AI Copilot would riff off my bespoke code to tell me what I should write next. And that was an amazing moment because lawyers had the same problem with our product where like they want something that's going to help automate their workflow, but it was never bespoke enough. You know, templates were too rigid. Templating software for lawyers has been around since the 70s. It's called document automation. It was a big thing in the 70s, but it never just caught on. We were like the 100th company to try this. And everyone was like, oh, lawyers, like, you know, they're so bad at adopting technology. Like, and I was pissed off at our customers. Not really, but like, you know, I was pissed off. I was like, oh, why don't...
Yeah. Frustrated, yes.
Yeah, frustrated. Like, well, why don't these lawyers, you know, use this product? Like, they're foolish. And it's actually, no, the lawyers are right. Like, the rigid templating approach to automating contracts just kind of sucked. And it took me too long to realize this from our customer feedback, but like every deal is unique. Manually massaging text and getting it right for your client really matters. Your client has its own unique history as a corporate entity and its own unique things it's trying to do. Everything actually is really bespoke in law. And so the amazing aha moment for us was like with GitHub Copilot in software engineering was like seeing that this LLM could riff off of bespoke code and generate new code. And we said, this is like what our customers want. It wasn't like, oh, we're going to apply AI towards law. It was like, we finally have the tool that solves our customers' problem and all the things that they keep saying to us. We finally have the answer to it. And almost immediately, we made a V1 of that in about 2 weeks, actually in evenings and weekends. It wasn't even part of our main plan. We were like, yeah, we're going to hack this together. Really crappy early version. But as soon as we showed it this was before ChatGPT, actually.
So this was what? Like what was V1?
V1 was, I don't know if you've seen GitHub Copilot, but it's basically autocomplete, you know, for your code.
Got it.
And so ours was autocomplete for lawyers, basically. It was we built a Word add-in with a button that says like, you know, draft or whatever. And you could be writing a contract and you could just hit like autocomplete and it would like complete what you were typing. And that was it. That was really the first feature. And we also had a feature called like, explain to a 5-year-old where you could like highlight some text that would explain that in like client friendly language. But it was really the autocomplete feature that took off. We demoed that to our first lawyers and it was an immediate difference from anything we had ever seen before. Their pupils dilated. NFX has this great article. I don't know if you've read it, Find the Fast Moving Water. Have you seen this one before?
I'm going to check that out.
It's an awesome blog post that came out around the same time. And it talks about during these like inflection points and points where really groundbreaking products come out, you actually see customers have like a neurochemical reaction to seeing the product for the first time, where their brain is like reconfiguring to be like, holy cow, like my whole life is about to change. And we saw that, you know, just this one little feature.
That's awesome.
Showing it to lawyers, you could just see, you know, the rest of their career flash before their eyes, and they're like, holy cow, like something is actually here that's going to change how I practice. Sometimes it's, you see a little bit of fear, sometimes you see excitement, but it was like this
emotional, right,
wild moment. And then this was before ChatGPT. It was summer of 2022. So we rolled that out very quickly to some beta users. They loved it.
And all your KPIs, that the ones that you were tracking this time, were kind of in the right place, retention, usage, et cetera.
All the KPIs were off the charts. You know, CAC payback was like, you know, below 1 month. It was like, wow, immediate CAC payback, and usage was like we had never ever seen before.
What was some of the wording you used in those ads? Like, how did you describe this?
Oh,
remember?
It's a great question. I don't even know. I actually can't remember, because we had an ad that was like, you know, kind of riffing off of like, you know, GPT for lawyers sort of thing. But this was before anyone knew what GPT,
right,
ChatGPT, yeah, was. So yeah, I think it was like draft and review contracts 10 times faster, right in Microsoft Word, with like an image of the product working. And it was like the image or the video of the product working that I think was a big part of it.
Okay.
Sometimes that image or that GIF speaks louder than words. And that's really important. One thing I would say is like, we figured out a lot of patterns along the way that went into this. It wasn't like we just kind of struck it lucky. There was a whole bunch of learnings that we made along the way that made us build this. One, we realized getting lawyers to go to a web app is almost impossible. Like, that alone is too much friction for a product for lawyers in 2024. So we built the Word add in, and that was like a crucial decision for us. No one else did that.
I didn't even know you could build something for Word, to be honest. Like, I don't have any plugins in my Word.
It wasn't very popular at the time. Our developers cringed. They're like, really, we're going to like deal with these messy Microsoft APIs? Like, this doesn't sound like fun. But that spikiness and that contrariness is part of what, you know, helped us have this big lead on the market. We knew how hard it was to even get them to go to a web app. So that was like crucial. The other thing we learned is like, you have to be able to explain what your product is in like a 5 second GIF. And if you can't, it's like no one has the attention span for it anymore. So we knew it had to have that like element where you have a 5 second video and someone's like, holy cow, what is this? We knew it had to work with bespoke documents, and we knew that the time to value had to be zero. And that's like, you know, a huge pattern that we still use today when we launch new things is like, no one has time for configuration, controls, like setting things up anymore. It has to be, you turn the thing on and it immediately works. These things became very important to now, even as we launch new features, these attributes become like really important aspects for how we, you know, evaluate new features and their potential, you know, fit. And if you get those right, you see actual usage on the usage charts, which most of the time you don't.
This is the interesting thing, right? About like, and there's this broad concept, right? Like, you make your own luck, or however you want to talk about that, right? But you had actually two things. One is spend a lot of time with your customers, so really understood them and how they work, but also effectively build like a machine that was really good at acting on a new idea and trying to figure out, delivering something really quickly and trying to figure out if there's true pull, right? And so, like, all those things had been done for, you know, years when this moment happened. And so makes sense that it worked out in the way it did.
Yeah, I think there's one way I would like compress all our insights into a framework that I would say has enabled us to create these PMF moments way faster now than we could back then. The big thing, and this has been like this amazing breakthrough on our team in terms of how we decide what to build next and how to replicate these moments, not every 4 years, but every, you know, 3 or 4 months, is this framework we call basing the next features you build based on pattern matching, not based on verbal reasoning. And I think this is how we screwed up so much and how many companies screw up, and how I think you can make really good bets. And what I mean by this is, when we first started, we used verbal reasoning to explain what we're going to buy. Lawyers want to make more money, therefore we're going to give them a store. These sorts of little simple narratives are so contagious at the board level, at the founder level, at the company level. That little phrase I just said, lawyers don't care about efficiency. They want more clients. Therefore, we're going to build them a store. It's so easy to build these little narratives that are super powerful and super contagious, and to go all in on them because everyone thinks they sound reasonable. We learned over and over again that actually that kind of thing is actually really bad, because the world is way more hyper-dimensional than that. There are way more characteristics about a feature that will determine whether it's successful or not. And we learned that like the form of the feature, whether it's in Word or not, actually matters more than almost the product itself. Because if you're building a web app for lawyers, sorry, you already lost the game. So whether that story makes sense doesn't matter. There's so many other characteristics. So like the characteristics we look at are like, is it zero time to value? Can it be explained in a 5-second GIF? Does it require zero habit change? Is it already in the workflow? The other characteristic we have is, did someone on our team actually build this based on their own inspiration in their own time? That's like a huge thing that we've noticed is almost everything that we've built that was really successful, someone was actually just inspired to go and hack on their own outside of our normal development cycles. So we have 16 of these characteristics. And we've learned that by instead of doing pattern matching against a whole bunch of attributes, we can be way more successful. I think this applies in like investing too. Like I think you're like a pattern matcher, and like investors kind of get that like, oh, I'm gonna invest in like this cobalt mining company because they have a contract with Tesla. And if you invest in a story like that, you're just gonna end up piling on with a bunch of retail investors who like have this very contagious story that's really compelling. And then, you know, there's this big spike and bubble and bust kind of thing on that stock.
I think that's huge because the problem that you described is exactly how it happens, right? And this is just how almost every product idea, feature idea comes alive. And you have a story. And by the way, most founders are actually quite good at telling stories. The higher IQ you are, the better you are at telling stories, and the better you are at convincing yourself and others. And so the stories make a lot of logical sense. They're overly simplified because they have to be, and they miss a lot of the nuance. This new approach of pattern matching across characteristics that, you know, have worked. In your case, obviously, you had done enough features to know, to have a sample size to say, these are the ones that worked more, and these are the characteristics they had. You probably could start with some first principles around, you know, things like zero time to value, easy to communicate, probably apply broadly. And if you think about your customer set, you probably can come up with some other ones. So that's really helpful, even at the outset. But let me ask this, how do you come up, like just to make sure that I understand it, do you still, because humans think more in verbal kind of logical reasoning than they do pattern matching, is that still what you use to come up with an idea, but then you use pattern matching to test the idea? Or are you somehow able to use just the characteristic framework to come up with ideas in the first place?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think ideas can come from anywhere. So they can totally come from the verbal reasoning. The characteristic framework is the gut check on like, okay, validating like, okay, could this actually work? So ideas can come from stories, totally. They can come from all sorts of weird places. You also need stories to motivate a team. A team is not motivated by staring at a spreadsheet of numbers.
But to be clear, it's not like you have a framework where you have these characteristics and you're somehow able to go from that to, oh, maybe this feature will work. Or do you? Because that seems hard and unintuitive.
Yeah, no, we don't use it for idea generation. It's more so we have a list of 50 things we could do. How do we rank which one to actually do? Yeah, but it is tough. Founders have to be good storytellers. So there's sort of, I always call it, you know, the storytelling power is sort of this dark magic. And you have to be very careful because it can screw up your own radar if you use it in the wrong way.
Well, the worst part of being a good storyteller is you believe yourself.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I have become more skeptical of simple stories and, you know, though, generally as like, because they're so contagious and because people rally around them so quickly, those are the ones where I apply the framework more intensely because I'm like, okay, hang on. Like this is.
I love it because the way I see it happen from my vantage point is, you know, it's important across the board, but it's so common in pre-product market fit because we're trying to find something that could work, right? And so you'll kind of have the founder tell you, so actually what we're going to try now is this thing, here's like how we came up with this and here's why it makes sense. And you kind of think, you know, what I end up thinking to myself is, because I've seen it so many times, I'm like, yeah, it makes a lot of sense. I guess we'll see what happens, right? Because I don't have like, but your thing is like, that makes a lot of sense. You put it against this thing and it's like, actually, it is likely to succeed, or like, no, actually, it's not likely to succeed. It gives you that extra data point because that's what it's all about is you have a lot of ideas, but you only have limited time. Even if you're the fastest team possible, you still are not going to get through all of them. And you certainly don't want to get through all of them if you don't have to. So like finding a way to reorganize these, not on which one, who's the loudest voice in the room, which one is the best story, but something a little bit more that's like quantitative hard data, That's great. And honestly, I hadn't heard of that at all before. So I'm really glad you shared it.
Humans need stories to communicate and operate and be motivated. So you need it to some level, but you have to have an inner circle, and your board meeting has to be this place where you actually are really careful about this drug. You know, it's a drug. It screws up your perception of reality. You know, I know there are lots of board meetings that are driven by these stories and people nodding their head to me like, yeah, that makes sense. I think you have to kind of create this somewhat story-free zone, or like this safety zone where we think about things a little differently. Otherwise, it's too easy that for the boardroom to become this, like, you know, storytelling place where we all convince ourselves of things that are really a little bit too simplified and, yeah, not really, you know, digging into the data and stuff.
Maybe my next question is, like, when did you, you know, there's a difference between a new feature and changing the company's name and kind of going all in on this. How did that transition happen?
Yeah, so we actually did it out of the gate. So one thing, I've become very, like, cognizant of, like, how simple is it for the user to grasp this? I thought that by splitting this out as its own website and brand, it would just be simpler to communicate what it is. Whereas if it's like, oh, Rally launches an AI feature, it's immediately just like info overload. Like, what's Rally? What's all this other stuff? How does this fit in? It's so confusing. So if I had my time back, those 100 landing pages, I wouldn't have put under Rally. I would have been like, spin up a new domain names. You get this feature cruft, and your feature list growing is actually not a good thing. It actually overwhelms customers. It starts to feel like it's overlapping with other products they're using. And this is actually the first time we're like, you know what, we're just going to split it in a totally different brand and test it that way.
That's so smart. Actually, I haven't heard of that. I mean, every now and then somebody spins up a new product, but just the idea of almost every new meaningful feature in this pre-product market fit phase, obviously, it might as well just be a new brand. Like, you might as well just start from zero, take all the sunk cost out, and be as clear as possible. You give it the best chance of success. Like, that resonates. That makes a lot of sense.
Exactly. Because, yeah, the growing feature list weighs down your new thing so much. And also, like, figuring out how you're going to integrate this new thing and everything you already do and make it all make sense. It's like, it's not supposed to make sense. You're trying experiments. You don't have to combine all the work you did together. Yeah, get rid of the sunk cost. All you're looking for is lightning in a bottle. You know, all the failed experiments, you don't need to keep them. So, yeah, we did that. But then we eventually changed the company name. That took a little longer to fully go all in. I remember the first time we kind of brought these results to our board, because we had not talked about this up to this point. We had started experimenting this. It was just like an evening and weekend experiment. We had other stuff going on. We came back to the board. We're like, hey, we launched this little thing, and like, here's the growth chart. It's like, this is going to eclipse all the work we did in the past 3 years within like 3 months. Everyone was just like, wait, what? Like, what's going on? This is, I think you had some element of confusion and worry, like, does this company know what it's doing? Like, you never told us about this. Like, what? Like, where did this come from? And I was like, I think we got to go all in on this, you know?
Right.
And it's just like, oh my God, like, you build up all this context over years of what the product is. And then all of a sudden you're saying, leave all that behind. And I had been communicating with our investors in the background too. So it wasn't like complete surprise, but, you know, it was a weird moment of like, hang on a minute. This is strange. But then it didn't take very long for our team and board to come to a consensus like, yeah, you know what? These are absolutely stellar growth numbers. And this is going to eclipse everything we've done over the last 3 years.
What did you do with your customers on Rally? Did you just like abandon Rally, or did you still have it and it's just in the background?
No, yeah, we still have it. We still sell it. And we're still, I would say the value prop of templates still exists within our ecosystem of Spellbook. Spellbook, we want it to be the ultimate AI assistant for corporate and commercial lawyers. Templating is still an aspect of what our customers want to do, for sure. So that templating engine will roll in slowly into Spellbook as a feature, because it is actually useful for certain things that lawyers want to do.
You know, I know obviously, like, you kind of mid-2023, you raised about $10 million, and then 6 months-ish after that, so earlier this year, you raised another 20 or so. So clearly there's something going on, but can you give a sense of scale, like number of customers, maybe just like curious, like, what Rally was like at that time, and then like how fast and how big like Spellbook has gotten?
Yeah. So yeah, Rally, you know, we had around 100 law firms. Now we're close to 2,000 law firms on board.
Wow.
Around the world. Yeah.
That's
so
insane.
Yeah. And that's in, you know, a little over a year, you know, a year to a year and a half, you know, we went to 2,000 law firms. So, you know,
that's product market fit.
That's
product market fit.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. We're in a lot of different countries. Yeah. We see between 1 and 2 million contracts a year right now go through our system. So
perfect. So. Well, look, we'll stop it there. You know, I usually end with two questions, but one of them, I think you already answered, which is, when did you first feel like you had true product market fit, and you went to a lot of detail on the emotional response. So I'll skip that one. I'll ask you the other one, which is, if you could go back to about 2018 when you were just starting Rally with kind of one piece of advice for yourself as a founder, what might that be?
One, that the intuition to stay lean until you find PMF was right, because we did question that a lot, and we got, and it was very hard to maintain that conviction. It was some like really difficult conversations with stakeholders on like why we weren't, you know, scaling out or growing faster. I would tell myself like, you know, that was right, and I probably could have saved myself some sleep if someone had told me that more people had told me that was right. And the other thing is what I mentioned also, like, you know, everything doesn't have to bolt on the same product when you're in the pre-PMF stage. It's a totally different game. It has nothing to do with the post-PMF stage almost. You're trying a bunch of stuff. So launch different apps, launch different brands. Don't get stuck in that sunk cost. I think we made a big mistake in like trying to bolt everything onto one foundation to make it feel like all our work was accumulating. That probably slowed us down a lot. Keep launching stuff. Don't worry about the sunk cost. It only takes one landing page and one feature, you know, to have that breakthrough moment. You don't need 10, 20 features all bolted together.
Perfect. Well, thanks a lot, Scott. Really appreciated some great insight here. And I think a lot of lessons actually for founders to take away.
Thanks, Pablo, for having me. I really appreciate it.
I just gave you content that you liked so much, you actually listened to the end. And guess what? You didn't pay a single dollar. Not only that, I didn't even put any ads in your face, right? So you just got a bunch of content for free. And now that I've delivered that value, I'm asking for something in return. Open your app, open Apple Podcasts, open Spotify, open whatever app you use to listen to this, and hit that follow button. It's actually going to help you, because it's going to help you make sure you don't miss out on the next episode, which you like so much that you listen to the whole thing.